The more the world changes, the more we find comfort in the things that never change. Never change. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand, on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome to the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. Thank you so much for tuning in and being part of the show. The show where I, your rabbi, reveal how the world really works. And, of course, one of the ways the world really works, in fact, all the ways the world really works, involve me telling you things that are entirely different from the things that are being said and the things that are being written popularly out there. And it is not for the purpose of being iconoclastic or shocking or politically incorrect. It's simply a case of me having zero value to you if I am not telling you the truth about how the world really works. And I was watching the erection of a tower crane on a building site recently, this last week. And I find those things absolutely fascinating. These tower cranes, as you know, these huge, slender-looking towers that look improbably balanced against the forces of wind and weather. And they have these huge jibs extending outwards. And little by little, as a building rises, the tower crane rises with it. And there are two types of tower cranes. One is erected by means of a second crane that hoists the sections of the tower crane into place. And the other one is even more interesting, and this is the one I really enjoy watching, and that is where the tower crane grows itself. The crane hoists up a section that is going to be the next section of the tower. It looks like, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 feet long. And meanwhile, jacks hoist up the tower until there's a gap of exactly the size that'll fit the new incoming piece, and voila, the tower is now 15 or 20 feet higher, and so it grows. Anyway, why am I telling you all this? Because as I watch the site, and there are a lot of people at work, right? People involve trucks bringing construction material, people pouring concrete, people setting forms and reinforcing. And I got to tell you, I not only looked, but I actually asked, because I wanted to be able to speak about this on the show. Were there any women working on the site? And again, if you have anything of a clue about how the world really works, then you know the answer already. No, there were no women working on this particular construction site or the other one that I happened to stop and watch as well. Why? It's perfectly obvious, right? You don't need me to tell you that. And as a matter of fact, there is a feminist woman professor in Philadelphia called Camille Puglia, whom I have not met, but I think I'm really going to try to. I find her extraordinarily impressive. She says she is a feminist. She's a woman, but in one of her recent books, she has a passage that I marked in which she said that if women were in charge of civilization, we would all still be living in grass huts. Now, this sounds, does it not, as if today's show is going to be a hate on women show, right? Well, you know me better than that. And I am going to talk about women. I'm going to tell you not only a fact, but why the fact is and how it works. The fact is very simple. The fact is that most women, even though many of them would protest this and argue it, most women are drawn to strong, confident, ambitious men. That's not the same as saying that women are drawn to loutish arrogance and floundering bullying. No, of course not. But most women are attracted to strong, confident, ambitious men, men who know what they're doing in the world, men who've got their lives worked out. And something I've noticed, both in Jewish ministry and Christian ministry, there are certain groups of Jews, Bible-believing, committed, serious Jews, who are deeply committed to spreading the faith. And they'll go out to locations that may have only a small population of Jews, but no services at all and no availability of kosher food, etc. And a young couple will go out, leaving behind their families, and set up locations, you know, in really every corner of the world. And it's really rather remarkable. They are unbelievably dedicated, and in this sense, very similar to the many Christian friends I have, who, again, a couple, you sometimes newly married, sets out to start a new congregation, to plant a church, to engage in ministry. And here is something that I have noticed, and that is, well above average, like this is way beyond just the what would might be the statistical probabilities, way beyond, on both the Jewish and the Christian side, these pastors and rabbis seem to have the most extraordinary wives. They are beautiful, they are put together women, they're competent women. And side by side with their husbands, as full 100% partners, the two of them build up a presence. As I say, whether it is a synagogue or whether it's a church. And years ago, I found myself already asking myself this, why is it that these men seem to attract incredible women? And the answer is very simple. They may not be going to make a whole lot of money in their lives, but they won't be hungry. They'll be all right, and their families will be fine. They're not going to be spectacularly rich. They're not going to be rich at all, but they are going to do just fine. So how do they end up attracting such magnificent women? And the answer is because they are strong, they are confident, they are ambitious, and they know what they're doing in life. They know what their purpose is. They know what they're trying to build. And any man in any field like that stands an above-average chance of attracting an above-average woman. Okay, so why am I telling you all of this? Because one of the things that I come across a great deal, both in letters that come to me at our website, we get a lot of letters and I do read them all, is the letter that is so common that I can almost write the text. It's so standardized. And that is men asking me, why should they get married? After all, 50% of marriages are going to end in divorce. They've got a 1 in 2 chance of being divorced. And divorce wipes them out financially. And they lose their children in custody battles. And they just can't see any point in getting married. Not only that, and this is a regular feature as well, and I've written about this in our thought tools. And again, just a little plug here. If you're not receiving the weekly emailings from us, why don't you go and subscribe on our website and make sure you do? Because if these topics interest you in any way at all, then I do put out a lot of information there, including information that I don't do on the show itself. So try and make sure you get Thought Tools, and you can subscribe quite easily on our website. Also, the website, you can go back and read, you know, many, many, many earlier issues of Thought Tools that have passed by. But I've spoken about this and written about this, that men say not only do they stand a high chance of getting divorced, and divorce will wipe them out, but even before that time, they marry these wives who start running their lives who make them feel that they have to beg for physical connection, and that somehow the joys of marital life never actually materialize for them. So they see little reason for getting married. Some of the men who write to me are already married and bemoaning the circumstances in which they're living and saying, had they only known what this was going to be like, they never would have got married. There's a lot of this negativity, and a lot of the letters speak about the fact that they don't want to marry because of the factors I've already mentioned. Also, that women are bossy and women are pushy and women are money-grabbing, and just generally an incredibly negative take on women in general. First of all, I just want to clarify that the marriage failure rate is not 50%. This was a lie that I think was originally perpetrated by the New York Times when they started listing together all marriages, first marriages, second marriages, third marriages. And it is true that when taken together, all of the marriages, in other words, look at every marriage that occurred in, shall we say, 2014, and by 2018, it was clear that a very high proportion of them were either divorced or going to be divorced, heading in that direction. So you should be aware that that is one of these misleading statistics. It is true that divorce rates for second marriages are much higher than for first marriages, which makes sense when you think about it, right? You are likely to be older, more set in your ways, less able to adjust to this entirely new reality of combining your life with somebody else's. Secondly, having done something once, doing it a second time is a little easier. The thought of divorce is horrifying. Unless you've done it twice already, in which case a third time you think, I've been through this already, I can do it again. So not surprisingly, divorce rates for second marriages are higher. Divorce rates for third marriages are still higher. And so when you lump them all together, you do get a 50% rate. However, the success rate for first marriages is well over 70%. According to some numbers, over 80%. So it's first marriages do very well for people to say automatically, well, I stand a 50% chance of a divorce. Not true. Not true at all. Anyway, in addition to that, what I feel I have to devote some time to today is explaining that feminism, with all its drawbacks and with all its flaws, with all the unhappiness it has brought to women and men, feminism, my friends, is largely a creation of men. Yes, all you guys out there complaining bitterly about what women are like can thank the men before you for making them that way. What on earth am I talking about? Why is it men's fault that women have become the feminist unpleasant model and image that popular culture shows them to be? And this is done by men? Sure it is. And I will explain exactly what I mean as we come back, right? The website is rabbidaniellappin.com. And at rabbidaniellappin.com, you can not only take a look at a resource that is probably a really good idea for anybody contemplating marriage, for young people looking at a first marriage, and this is primarily for people in a dating situation or a courting situation. The book is called Hands Off, This May Be Love, and it is a very compelling and cogent and persuasive argument for not touching the woman you're dating. That's right. That's right. I know it sounds shocking, but the argument is a good one. And if you think about it, you can probably come up with some of them yourselves. But to underestimate the power of sex to change your thinking and to change your mind during the dating process is to voluntarily admit to one of the most important decisions you're likely to make in your life, considerations that remove your ability to think clearly and diminish your capacity to exert logic and rationality to the decision you have to make. Anyway, it's a fascinating book, and if you know people who are on the threshold of getting into the dating, courting, getting married process, hands off This May Be Love is a really useful book. And while you're at RabbiDanielAppin.com, please make sure that you do get yourself on the subscription list for Thought Tools so that you can get a better sense of some of the deeper implications of the things we discuss right here. This is the show that I am taping just before Christmas 2018. And so I take this opportunity of wishing all you Christian listeners a very joyful and uplifting Christmas as you contemplate a blessed, prosperous, and happy year ahead. I hope you're going to get to be able to spend Christmas with loved ones, and that it will be a very special, heartwarming time, a time that will rejuvenate you and refresh you and prepare you for a spurt of creativity as you face the struggles and challenges of life ahead. Those struggles and challenges whose overcoming brings real happiness in all of our lives. Now, I want to touch on a scientific principle because science is very important. Science helps us measure and observe, well, how the world really works on a physical level. And Susan Lappin always warns me that when I discuss scientific topics, I run the risk of losing all the female listeners to this show. And all I can say is I disagree with her. I think my wife is entirely wrong on that. I simply do not accept that women listeners turn off on science. Now, I do understand and accept that the percentage of women who choose study and careers in the science and the technology and the engineering and the math fields, I understand that that's far lower than the number of men who do so. Furthermore, I do not believe that this is because of acculturation or sexism or anti-womanism or these fields trying to keep women out. I don't accept anything of that at all. I think that sexes are different from one another and that the natural interests of men and women are different from one another. Exceptions, obviously, it goes without saying. I myself know several rocket scientists, literally, who are women. One is married to a nephew of mine, and so I'm not unfamiliar with that. But in general, that having been said, I would like to talk about a scientific principle that, to begin with, was attributed to, I think, Aristotle. It goes back a long time. At any rate, it's not a difficult concept to grasp at all, but the way it's traditionally articulated is nature abhors a vacuum. Okay, and what is a vacuum? Well, a vacuum is anywhere where there is nothing. It's a space in which there's absolutely nothing there. Not even air, no gas, no nothing. By the way, space is a vacuum. Most of the distance between the Earth and the Moon, most of the difference between the Earth and the Sun is empty. It's pure space. And nature abhors a vacuum, it's pure vacuum is what I meant to say. Nature abhors a vacuum. What do I mean by this? Well, think for a moment of how a drinking straw works. By the way, you all know about the silly lie that 20 million straws are thrown into the ocean every day from America. Again, complete and utter nonsense, a number pulled out of thin air. And as a result of this, foolish places have started limiting the number of straws that they allow clients or customers at the restaurant to have. Anyway, all of that is nonsense. But I like straws, I use straws, and I enjoy the plastic straws because they don't dissolve and mess and fail during a long drink. Anyway, but how does a straw work? You put it to your lips, and before you do anything at all, in the straw, you will notice that the level of the liquid is the same as the level in the glass. Nothing's happened. As you insert the straw, the liquid in the straw rises to the same level as the level in the glass. Then you put your lips to the straw and you start sucking on it. When that happens, what happens is you are creating a vacuum in the column in the straw. And when that vacuum becomes empty enough, something rushes in because nature abhors a vacuum. And what rushes in? Well, there is air pressure pushing on the liquid in your glass. And normally there's nowhere for it to go. In the same way that, you know, there's air pressure pushing down the water in a swimming pool and you're oblivious of that. You don't know about it at all. If there was no gravity and no air pressure, it would be very difficult to keep water in the pool. It would float out of the pool and float around, as the now famous pictures we're accustomed to seeing of people in space stations where there is no gravity. But talking just about air pressure, not gravity, the liquid is forced up the straw. You don't suck it up the straw. All you do is create a vacuum, and the air pressure then pushes the liquid because nature hates leaving a vacuum and things rush in to fill it. Quick question, if that's the case, why doesn't the air, there's about 4 or 5 miles of air atmosphere surrounding our Earth, why doesn't it rush off to the vacuum of space? And the answer is obvious, that the planet's gravity attraction pulls on each molecule of air, keeping it close to Earth, preventing it from escaping into space. But vacuums tend to want to be filled. And this is one of these beautiful scientific rules that has a very clear and obvious human real-life equivalent. What happens if you have weak leadership in government? Well, nature abhors a vacuum. And if there's a vacuum of leadership, then you get a tremendous rise in bureaucratic power. In other words, if elected representatives renege on their responsibility to control the bureaucracies, which has been happening for a few decades now already, Congress basically abandons its responsibility to supervise the various offices of government, whether it's the EPA or the Energy Department or the Education Department. All of these huge bureaucracies that are created by the federal government, in the absence of leadership, they tend to assume leadership. And the colossal increase in rules and regulations that have over the last few decades stifled so much of life in America, business as well as other areas, is a natural result of nature abhors a vacuum. Create a power vacuum, and other people will seize the power rushing in there. This is true in business as well, right? Exactly the same thing, where if you do not have a strong and effective leadership at the top, you have a vacuum. There's a leadership vacuum, and not surprisingly, there will be a rush in to fill that vacuum, and it is generally going to be a chaotic sequence of events that follow, simply because the quality of leadership that flows in as a result of a genuine leadership vacuum is not necessarily what is in the best interests of the company long term, although it's very much in the best interests of those who seize the opportunity and rush in to fill the power vacuum. And so really, one of the things that leadership has to do, one of the many things that leadership, one of the responsibilities and obligations of leadership that are not often spoken about or not even often understood, is that leadership needs to control the ambition of up-and-comers, making sure that is redirected for the benefit of everybody, as opposed to destructive coups. What is a coup? A coup is essentially something that happens when there's a power vacuum at the top. Anyway, back to women. What we see happening in America today is very simply a power vacuum that began, yes, you're right. You know, I always tell you everything started in the 60s. Well, yes, it was in the 60s that it began. And men started backing out of responsibility. Men started reneging on their responsibility to be men. See, the normal process of any society is that you have to acculturate your boys to become men. You don't have to worry about the girls, because girls generally are going to become young women automatically. That's what happens. But little boys do not become men automatically. This is one of the great challenges facing any society. How do you make this all work correctly? The problem, as I say, is not the women. The problem is the boys. If you do not educate them to become men, you don't acculturate them to be men, then they stay boys forever. And when they stay boys forever, then there is going to be a power vacuum. I know many people will say, so what? There shouldn't be a power vacuum. Power should be shared between men and women. That is a little bit like saying that power should be shared in the army between the commanders and the enlisted men. It doesn't work that way. That's not how the world really works. And you'll remember, I mentioned earlier, that the majority of women, by far and away most women, would rather be married to a man that they do look up to and respect, not a man who lets them do, this is going to be disturbing to many people, but most women prefer being married to a man who holds the steering wheel, married to a man who takes responsibility for the direction of the marriage and the family and the home, a man who takes responsibility for the children, a man who takes responsibility for the finances. And in the same way that the overwhelming majority of women are far happier riding in the passenger seat of the car than men would be happy in that position, it's one of the reasons that even after several decades of feminism, the overwhelming majority of cars that you will see in your morning commute that have a couple in them will have the man driving, not the woman driving. And so what happened is that men never emerged. It was Peter Pan time. And from the 60s, boys started remaining boys. How do we see this? Well, I'm going to explain it, and I'm also going to explain it in the context of some popular entertainment. You ready? But before I do that, let me remind you again of the website, rabbidaniellappin.com. The resource I want to suggest you take a look at is called Hands Off, This May Be Love. It's a very powerful book. It's a short book. It's effective. And the best thing is you can get it either in paper form at the website, or you can get it on Kindle, right? If you're somebody who likes doing your reading electronically, perhaps you want to read on your commute or when you're traveling, whatever it is, download it on Amazon onto Kindle. The name of the book, Hands Off, This May Be Love. I didn't write the book. I published the book. but it's called Hands Off, This May Be Love, and I think you will find it to be very useful indeed, particularly if you are raising children or playing a role in the education of grandchildren, or maybe you have a family member, who man or woman, who's thinking of starting to date or court somebody who's thinking of marriage. This is truly an absolutely invaluable resource. This is one of those things where I hear from people all the time, one of the most common letters, and by the way, you'll see this in the comment section of the Thought Tools on our website, people will often write and say, why didn't I know this stuff 30 years ago? Why didn't I know this at the time I was getting married? Why didn't I know this when I was beginning my career? I get that an awful lot of times. And this is one of those books that people would say, why didn't I know this back then? The book is called Hands Off, This May Be Love. And go to the rabbidaniellappin.com or Amazon, and you'll be able to explore the book more thoroughly. Okay, I said I was going to give you some examples from popular culture, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. If you still hear this show before Christmas, then know that I wish you a joyful and uplifting Christmas. And what we're talking about is men not playing the role of men. And as a result of that, women step into the breach, as they have to. Now, again, this doesn't work in an abstract world. This isn't a world of theory. Secular fundamentalists adopt the Marxist point of view that all of history is played out by struggles within race, gender, and economic class. And so it's not, oh, there's this great big group called women who did these things. No, there isn't such a thing. But what happened is something that played out in millions of individual interactions. It played out in millions of homes, in millions of marriages, in millions of dating interactions, where men turned out not to be men, but to be boys. Now, I usually mention 1962, 63 as roughly the time when things really seriously began to plummet downwards in the culture. Now, the reason I select that date is for a variety of different proofs. But one of them that is interesting, I think, is that the birth control tablet came onto the market at that period. And that was perhaps the first time that men could now replace masculine honor and responsibility with simply, did you remember to take your pill, honey? And so not surprisingly, the area that most effectively propelled boys into manhood was the area of sex. The idea that you take responsibility as a boy or as a man, not as a boy, but as a man, you take responsibility for a woman, you cherish her, you support her, you love her, you try and make her happy your whole life. That notion slipped away. And the result was, well, it's shared. Everybody, there's the benefits accrued to both in sex, both have the same responsibilities, and things started going downhill. I said I'd show you some examples from popular culture, and, you know, it's enough to make you weep sometimes. I do want to show you something that goes back to the 60s. And before I even go there, I just want to make certain that none of you are intimidated at all by the popular culture response to any time you look back, and you look back in nostalgia. For instance, I think everybody knows that the poverty figures for Black Americans in general and to, in relationship to the rest of America, and the growth rates were actually better before the civil rights movement began. Crime rates, illegitimacy rates, actually stable marriage rates were actually higher in Black America than in white America up until 1963. So, you know, I say that and immediately everybody wants to jump on me and say, oh, you're trying to bring back the bad old days. You're trying to turn back the clock of racism and slavery. So one has to be able to dismiss such foolishness. Right? One can, like in any time, right now, I can tell you that now is absolutely the best time to be alive, but it's also a very problematic time to be alive, right? There are lots of reasons why this is a wonderful time to be getting married and having children. It's also a very challenging time, and I can point out the advantages of today and also the disadvantages. It doesn't mean I'm overlooking either or dismissing either of them. So it is. If I'm going to go back and look at the 60s, there were pluses and there were minuses, obviously. But I'm focusing right now on the pluses because those were thrown out with the bathwater. And the results have been to make not only women, but men also very unhappy. Why? Well, because ultimately happiness for both a man and a woman is dependent on finding your other half, upon building a life together with someone of the opposite sex. Right? That's where happiness ultimately comes from, if that marriage is conducted correctly. If not, then a marriage can become a hellhole. But observing that reality doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with marriage, obviously. Okay, so with that having been said, let me go back and share with you something from a show called The Gilmore Girls. A very clever and capable woman writer, Amy Sheridan Paladino, I think is her name. I haven't met her, but she wrote The Gilmore Girls. And you know, there's a good reason there was such an incredibly successful series during the 2000s. So listen, if you would, to this brief little discussion. What happens is, for those of you who may not be in the know, there is a single mom, Lorelai, whose daughter Rory is, I don't know, at this point about 16 or something like that. And she's got an admirer, a young man who seems to be quite a bright guy, works in the local supermarket. I'm not fully up to date on everything, but that's enough background. He walks into their home as Lorelai and her daughter Rory are watching television. What are they watching? They're watching the Donna Reed show. What's the Donna Reed show? Donna Reed is plays Donna Stone, who is married to her pediatrician husband, Alex Stone. They got a son and a daughter. And this show ran 1958 to 1966, I think. So just the period we're talking about. And it is the home that everybody would have loved to have grown up in and been part of. A wise, powerful, patient, strong, loving father, a beautiful mother who just takes care of her husband and of her children and finds deep fulfillment in that. And it's a home where the children are cherished. It's a home in which the couple grows in love. It's a home in a neighborhood where neighbors care for one another, and where there is a serene predictability to life. It's beautiful. And any normal man who goes back and looks at clips from the Donna Reed show, if he's got a shred of masculine normality in him, he will instantly fall in love with Mrs. Stone on the Donna Reed show. And and he'll say, look, it's a show, it's unrealistic, it's impossible. Yes, it is. There have to have been times where she lost her temper. There have got to be times where she didn't look beautiful and perfect in a great frock with high heels and a pearl necklace There must have been times like that, right? This is a show, after all. But I think it was Oprah Winfrey who credited the show, and I may be wrong on this, but if not, it was then the Leave It to Beaver show, which had strong similarities. But I'm thinking it was Oprah Winfrey who says that seeing the show as a kid made her realize there was something else. There was the possibility of something worthwhile and terrific. And indeed, it serves that purpose. In other words, what your popular culture puts out there for consumption as the model is really very, very significant. Don't say that, you know, television just echoes reality. It doesn't. It plays a huge role in shaping it. And you might remember the horrible show of Married with Kids or Married with Children. I don't remember, with Al Bundy. Pretty much a dysfunctional marriage, and I never saw the humor in it, frankly. But if that's put out as normal marriage, then it becomes more acceptable for every husband who watches that week after week after week to be disrespectful to his wife. And this, however, is not what you saw on the Donna Reed show. So I'm going to play you just the scene I've been describing, where the boyfriend comes in and Lorelai and her daughter say, "Sit down, sit down." He says, "What are you watching?" And he says, "The Donna Reed show." And then I've left out a whole part of it. But the mother and daughter disparage Donna Reed in such catty, unpleasant terms, really. In witchy terms, if you know the word I'm trying to avoid saying, there it is. You'll hear it, and you'll see what it is I'm describing. Again, I always like reminding you to visit the website, because that is the raison d'être. What lies behind this show is the resources you can obtain at rabbidaniellappin.com. And in terms of anybody who is at that point in life, man or woman, thinking about preparing for a marriage and building a home, for real-life practical guidance in getting through the dating period, whether it's you or your children or your grandchildren or a nephew or a niece or friends of the family, whatever it is, please read up about this resource called Hands Off, This May Be Love. The idea, of course, is that touching plays an enormous role in shaping your decisions. And again, obvious to anybody who's lived a few years understands that the ability of a young man or young woman to accurately evaluate their feelings about one another and their ability to weld a life together is dramatically diminished the minute sexual sensation is involved in that relationship. So it's called Hands Off, This May Be Love. You'll see it at rabbidaniellappin.com. You can read about it more than I can tell you about it right here. Hands Off, This May Be Love. And you can also go on Amazon and download it as a Kindle, so you can have it that way as well. Hands Off, This May Be Love. And what I now want to do is play you for this little bit from the Gilmore Girls. Beautiful, isn't it? I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, written by Jewish Irving Berlin, and really one of the great Christmas songs. And there are many wonderful Christmas songs, are there not? And you know, one really, as you know, nobody is less inclined to find anti-Semitism lurking under every bush than me, but how else do you explain that Christians get I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, and this is what Jews get?
Dreidel, 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 I made it out of clay, and when it's dried and ready, oh, dreidel, we will play.
You see what I mean? I mean, really, what a contrast. That is really absolutely pathetic. Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel. But nonetheless, a nice time of the year, it certainly is. And I wish you, all my Christian listeners, a wonderful, a Merry Christmas and an uplifting Christmas with your friends and your families. Now, as I promised, here comes a few seconds of the Gilmore Girls talking about an earlier show. This episode of the Gilmore Girls, I think, first aired in 2001. And they're talking about a show that went off the air in 1966. Although I think you can still see it on, you know, some of the late night channels, I think, play some of these oldies. And if you've, I'm sure you've seen episodes of the Donna Reed Show, but if you haven't, you probably should take a look at it. Because I'm not saying that was normality, but I'm saying it was aspirational. People saw that that's what one aims at in creating a family. And I got to tell you, there's a world of difference going to be between a boy watching the Donna Reed Show as he grows up and a boy watching some of the slacker movies today. Boy grows up seeing movies about, all the movies about young men today, and to not realize the incredibly powerful impact that popular entertainment has on people is to miss what has happened in America over the last 50 years. So let's listen now to the Gilmore Girls.
Hey.
Hey.
Sit, you're missing it.
What are we watching?
The Incomparable Donna Reed Show.
So, who's Donna Reed?
What? You don't know who Donna Reed is? The quintessential 50s mom with the perfect 50s family?
Never without a smile and high heels?
Hair that if you hit it with a hammer would crack?
So it's a show?
It's a lifestyle.
It's a religion.
So what's this one about?
This one is actually quite filled with intrigue. The husband, Alex, comes home late for dinner and he didn't call.
Might as well kick the dog, too.
Oh, look, she's making donuts.
You're not even listening to the dialogue.
Ours is better.
I don't know. It all seems kind of nice to me.
What does?
Well, you know, families hanging together. I mean, a wife cooking dinner for her husband. And look, she seems really happy.
See what I mean? The vituperation of the two girls talking about Donna Reed. And I cut out a whole part of it just because of the interest of time. But the real thing I wanted you to hear was the plaintiveness. I don't know the details, and I'm sorry, I didn't have the time to check up on it. This boy, Dean, who sounds so plaintive when he thinks, you know what, that's not so bad, that's kind of nice. I don't know what his home background is and what he grew up in, I'm not sure. But I thought it was incredibly brave of the writers and the creators of this show to do an episode like this, where the girls are jumping all over the Donna Reed model, and it's this young man saying, you know what, that wasn't so terrible. And then I haven't actually seen this part of it, but later in that Gilmore Girls show, the daughter dresses up like Donna Reed for her boyfriend, and I don't quite know how that plays out. It doesn't matter for now. But what's interesting is that he really, it meant something to him. And he was made to realize, and he says, you know, I feel very unpopular now. He realized that this isn't what people are going for. But nonetheless, there it is. Now, one of the truly great American novels is a book by John Steinbeck called East of Eden. And in the Steinbeck Museum in Salinas, California, is a wooden box that John Steinbeck carved himself in which to submit the manuscript to his publisher. And there are pictures available of the box, and they're interesting because he beautifully carved the words East of Eden on the box, and then beneath that, carved very clearly and very accurately, is a Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is Timshol, and it shows up twice in this context in the first four chapters of Genesis. Okay. So the book East of Eden gets its name from Genesis chapter 4, verse 16. And Cain went out from before the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod to the east of Eden. And that was the title of the book. The whole novel revolves around the meaning of something that God said to Cain in verse 7 of chapter 4 of Genesis. If you succeed, sin may crouch. Sin will crouch at the door, and it will seek you out. But you will have the capacity to rule over sin. And then Cain nonetheless goes ahead and murders his brother Abel. But that word, and you will rule, you have the ability to rule over sin, is at the heart of Western notions of morality, right? In other words, nobody can say, my nature made me do it, or somebody else made me do it. If you commit a murder, then you did it, and you have to bear the responsibility for it, whatever it is. In other words, the very, very powerful thing that Steinbeck puts his finger on, a crucial verse which God says to Cain, you know what, there's always going to be sin out there. It's always going to be attractive. It's going to be tempting. But you, I've given you the ability to rule over it. Okay, fine. Now, in a totally different context, a chapter earlier, we get that word rule again. And this is in chapter 3, verse 16. Unto the woman he said, I will multiply the pain of childbirth, in sorrow will bring forth children. You will desire your husband that rules over you. And we're back at that word timshol. So used twice. Now, the point is that this is a thoroughly incorrect translation. It doesn't mean rule. In Hebrew, there are two words for ruling. One word is sholet, which means to rule with power and force at the point of a gun or with the threat of prison. It's the ruling that governments do or that kings do or used to do. And it's the ruling that that anybody who employs force or the threat of force over somebody else does. That word is not the word used in Genesis. It doesn't even show up in Genesis. The word that is used is this word timshol. And this word means to influence somebody, to bring compliance from somebody else through willpower and vision and persuasiveness. In other words, as I've often noted, Ayn Rand pointed out that the two ways of making somebody do what you want them to do is with a gun and with money. So she's wrong, because there's really a third way. The third way is through sheer force of will and vision, where and I gave an example when I wrote about this in the Thought Tool. I was at a charity banquet a little while ago, and I supported the cause. And I always have supported the cause, but I gave a larger than expected donation, and not because anybody called on me and said, Rabbi Lappin, what are you giving? And I was embarrassed. No, it didn't happen like that. There was no calling out. There was no shaming anybody who wasn't giving enough. It was all just completely voluntary and private. And I found myself giving more than I had planned to give when I came there. Reason? I was forced to do it by everyone else in the room. How? There was such an outpouring of generosity. And I saw people giving who had less than I have and were giving very generously. And I'm with them. I count me in. And I thought, hey, this is a good example. Nobody was pointing a gun at me. Nobody was going to embarrass me. Nobody was offering me money to give. This was a very simple thing. I was ruled over. I was ruled or influenced or impacted by the behavior of other people. And so it's often like that, where we're inspired to do things. Okay, now we're back to husband and wife. What the text actually says is that God said to Eve, and you will always desire a husband who can rule over thee. But the word rule, meaning strong, not forceful, not brutish, not tyrannical, not abusive, but basically back to the Donna Reed marriage model, which, by the way, is played out, you know, millions of times in fine American families right now, right today, and in countries all around the world. We have it's exciting for me, but the pins in my map are spreading dramatically, and we have listeners all over. And I just recently got a letter from somebody who said, please don't only talk about America. And you know what? You're absolutely right. So this point is valid around the world. There are marriages that are wonderful marriages, but in general, always because the woman feels fulfilled, and I'm using a word specifically here, surrendering herself to a man worthy of her love. Okay, you okay with that? That's the key thing. She's looking up to him. But what happens in all kinds of interactions, dating, courting, living together, cohabiting, marrying, where the man is not like this, where he's an overgrown boy, doesn't take responsibility for the family's finances, doesn't take responsibility for the disciplining and behavior of the couple's children. At this point, the woman becomes resentful. She does. And she says, this wasn't the deal. I'm not attracted to this man because I'm attracted to the man who can rule me. That's what we're talking about here. And it's very difficult to understand, I know. But what happened is that the Donna Reed Show went off the air in 66. Why? Because it was a time where boys were not turning into men. And so the show began to be anachronistic. You know, people would look at it and say, oh, this is not really realistic anymore. For the previous 8 years that the show ran, nobody said that then. People saw it as an aspirational thing. This is a nice marriage. I'm not sure it's realistic. I can't be like that all the time. You know, this Dr. Stone never gets angry with his kids. He's always, and everything works smoothly and beautifully. Okay, not like that in the real world. But at least I get an idea of what a marriage could be like. Well, that's all gone. And so over the ensuing decades, as boys stayed boys, women did what women have always done throughout history and managed, made sure that they still were able to take care of their children. And but at the same time, there was a resentfulness of the boys they found themselves involved with, certainly not powerfully attracted to, because they weren't men anymore, they were merely boys. And little by little, this morphed into the feminism we know of today, with all its hostility and its anger and its excesses and its craziness. But I got to tell you, from what I understand, goes on at most university campuses, not religious colleges in America, but most university campuses in America, I'd be shocked for women not to come out of that experience hating men. I get it. Because the men are not men, they're boys, and they are treating women horribly, and that carried on into the boys then graduate and go into their workplace, where they continued treating women abominably, as boys, not as men. A boy uses and abuses a woman, feeling nothing. A man loves, protects, supports, cherishes a woman. A boy seeks sexual gratification from a woman. A man seeks to give gratification. A man seeks to devote his life to making his wife happy. That's the difference, and it's a huge difference. That's as far as we're going to go today. bringing us to the end of today's show. Again, wishing you a wonderful Christmas. I hope you'll be spending it with friends and family. I also would like you to take a look at our website, rabbidaniellappin.com. See if you'd like to be on the mailing list for any of our weekly mailings, which I think bring real value in terms of strategies and techniques for life. And also take a look at the book I'm recommending to you, Hands Off, This May Be Love. And it's available on the website at rabbidaniellappin.com. You can read more about it there. See if it is something that you or somebody in your orbit of influence could use. And you can also look and read more about it at on Amazon. Hands Off, This May Be Love. And that means that we are at the end of today's show. I want to wish you a week of really good times with your family, with your friends, with your faith, and with your finances, for sure. I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin. God bless.
Spilling ancient solutions to modern problems in areas of family, faith, friendship, and finance. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand, on the Blaze Radio Network.